The other day we dropped in on a man who works on Capitol Hill. We found him by knocking on a door that said, Private. He led us through another door, into a cavernous room. It was the hearing room of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The man has written a memoir of his decades working for lawmakers who dominate rooms like this.
My name is Bertie H. Bowman. I was born in Somerton, South Carolina. I'm the hearing coordinator for the committee.
And we are actually sitting up behind this horseshoe table.
Yeah, I'm sitting in Senator Coleman's seat right now. I'm sitting in Senator Coleman's seat. It's for Minnesota.
And this is the hearing room where famous hearings on the Vietnam War were held.
This is the hearing room where the famous hearings were held during the Vietnam thing with John Kerry, the first lieutenant.
You mean when John Kerry came back from Vietnam and said, how do you ask a man to be the last man to die for a mistake? He's sitting at this table over here.
He sat at that table there.
And when senators meet these days to discuss Iraq or Iran, Bowman puts together the hearing agenda. If Richard Lugar or Barack Obama should ever need so much as a pencil, Bertie Bowman gets it. He calls his memoir Step by Step, and that's appropriate since his first job was sweeping the Capitol steps. As a young man, he fled to Washington from a South Carolina farm where his father was a sharecropper.
One day I went to McDougal's store, and all these cars, black shiny cars, and the chauffeurs all dressed neat and everything. And this man, this white man, Senator Maybach now I know, were running for re-election. That was back in 1944. I just had turned 13 years old. But when he left, his last words were, if you ever get to Washington, come by and see me. Boy, the people just clapped.
The South Carolina senator could not have known that Bertie Bowman really would come see him. The young man went on to work in a Capitol cafeteria. He drove senators' cars. He joined a small army of black employees who did anything senators asked. He got to know a lawmaker named Lyndon Johnson. He oversaw a young messenger named Bill Clinton. And he still works here, a big and gregarious man.
I'm 77. And as we say in soccer, I'm going on to 78.
He's liable to put a hand on your knee when he tells you a story. And he looks back in amazement at that white Southern senator who first gave him a job.
I didn't think that was going to happen like that, but we Southerners, we stick together.
You were too young to vote, and even if you'd been old enough to vote in 1944, odds are you weren't going to be allowed to vote.
No.
It wasn't like he was chasing a vote here.
And he just took a liking to me.
Do you think you became at some point more than just an employee, a guy doing downstairs work, as it was called, and attached to a senator?
I learned later on that every person who worked downstairs, they had a senator that they could go to. They would do things for each person. They had their man, they called it. And we just became friends.
Friends is the right word.
I would say friends, yeah. Or one Southern to another Southern, helping a Southern out.
Would you say friends is the right word for other senators that you worked for around? Strom Thurmond?
Yes.
William Fulbright?
Yes.
Did there come a time when it seemed strange to you that you felt like you were a friend to, a genuine friend with, these senators who were outspoken advocates of segregation?
Definitely, they were my friends.
Did it ever seem strange to you?
No.
How do you explain it? The difference between what they said and the idea that they seem to have treated you as a human being.
They had their political agenda and I had mine. Did you see my part in there about Thurmond? You know, Thurmond said, Bertie, I thought she was going to school. I said, I fill out applications, Senator. And I turned it in at Howard University. And I said, I've been waiting a long time. And he got on the phone. Robert, they speak to William Robert, administrator, please.
He called up the administrator of
Howard
University.
Yeah, because they were saying my grades are, you know. He said, Robert, don't you know that most of your money comes from the federal government? And then he hung up. He said, you go on back up there and you see Mr. William Roberts. I got in Howard University.
If you have somebody like Strom Thurmond, though, and he's given these segregation speeches.
You wonder how could he be so kind to me and say all these other bad things. Now, I'll be telling you a lie if I said some things he said didn't hurt me, if that's what you want to hear. He said it, but then again, I said, well, he's done so much. The good outweigh the bad, the way I look at it.
And regardless of what somebody like Strom Thurmond may have said about...
My mother always said, words don't hurt nobody.
Wow, a lot of people think words hurt a lot.
Well, in some cases, but my mother, I'm telling you what my mother said, and I believe her.
So you stood there and you basically said, I'm not going to worry about what Strom Thurmond says in a speech somewhere. I'm going to relate to him as a person, and he related to you as a person.
That's right. Fulbright voted against the Civil Rights Bill.
Fulbright, yeah.
Nobody never asked me about Fulbright. I mean, you know, I like Fulbright just like I like Thurmond. We were friends.
Fulbright ended up, as I understand it, dealing, ironically enough, with Martin Luther King. Because while they disagreed on segregation, they both opposed the war in Vietnam.
That's right. And we went to the, you know, the Reynolds, the backer group people?
Oh, R.J. Reynolds.
R.J. Reynolds, the backer people. You know, Fulbright and the Reynolds were very good friends. Went there one night, and I met Martin Luther King there. I was out there waiting for Fulbright, and he called, told me to come in. He said, Reverend King, I would like for you to meet Bertie, my staff, my driver, my everything. He's a good man. And I was really shocked, you know, that he took the time to call me in to introduce me to. But that was a good deal.
Some people who haven't spent time in the Capitol may find it amazing to think that you're up here, that you're working in this huge committee room, that you're working around 21 senators who are Democrats or Republicans, some of whom are running for president, and you're working hard to treat them all the same and be non-political. Some people may find that to be an impossible
task. Yeah, but it's
test.
Not hard working to try to treat them nice. Number one, my mother told me to be patient and do what you're supposed to do, be truthworthy, and be dependable. And that takes care of a lot of things. And I find out it takes care of a lot of things with me.
Bertie H. Bowman told his story in the hearing room of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And then he stood and held out his hand. It was time to take care of another Senate hearing that afternoon. Bowman's memoir is called Step by Step. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Two modest graves that rest side by side in the Montparnasse Cemetery in Paris have drawn a steady stream of visitors this spring. They contain the remains of two of the 20th century's most iconic intellectuals, Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. This year marks the centenary of Miss de Beauvoir's birth, and her pioneering work, The Second Sex, is still regarded as a cornerstone of modern feminist thinking. Frank Browning has this look back at her life.
There are a lot of reasons why Simone de Beauvoir is regarded as one of the towering figures of 20th century France. Her lifelong companionship with philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre, her many novels that are but thinly veiled diaries describing the private lives of the French post-war elite. But most important, says Annie Cohen-Solal, Sartre's biographer, is that Simone de Beauvoir was raised a proper Catholic girl, whose radical personal life outraged France's archaic Catholic men.
You know, France is extremely different from the United States on the point of view of feminism. The French are much more archaic. I mean, women were allowed to vote in France after World War II only, whereas feminism was active in the U.S. at the end of the 19th century. Beauvoir stepped into this very traditional society, so it's even more shocking for the French that she comes from this background. And she will be, together with Sartre, provoking French society.
Therein lies the essential contradiction of Simone de Beauvoir. The prim, often austere child of faded aristocrats, she not only took up with a godless philosopher, but she then set down all the details of her life, including the intimacies of her other lovers and Sartre's. For her biographer, Hazel Rowley, Beauvoir became a model of what it meant to live and to love freely.
I told my boyfriends at the time, just like Simone de Beauvoir and Sartre did, you have to love me in my freedom. Love is not about possession. Love is a very generous thing, which is about never holding anybody back. It's about not possessing people, but it's about actually loving them as free beings, which was difficult, I might add. It was difficult for them. It was difficult for me.
There were many other women in Sartre's life who, with Beauvoir, constituted a new kind of extended family. But in a late magazine interview, read here by an actor, Sartre credited Beauvoir as always having been his first and finest critic.
She was the only one at my level of knowledge of myself, of what I wanted to do. For this reason, she was the perfect person to talk to, the kind one rarely has. It is my unique good fortune.
Their unique relationship may barely raise an eyebrow in 2008, but it certainly did in the 1960s. It was even more outrageous in 1949 when Beauvoir wrote about the status of women in The Second Sex. When the book came out, it both became a quick bestseller and it drew massive hate mail. Not least, Hazel Rowley notes, for Beauvoir's most famous line.
On ne naît pas femme, on le devient. One is not born a woman, one becomes a woman. Which, of course, means that we don't have anything like female nature, the feminine mystique, all these kinds of concepts. Simone de Beauvoir attacked. She said that they were social conventions and that we choose to be women. We are programmed, we're socialized to be women, and that we are not determined in advance.
Worse, she attacked the privileges of French men, who have maintained even today a caste system that's faded in the rest of the West. An actor reads this passage from The Second Sex.
The advantage man enjoys is that his vocation as a human being in no way runs counter to his destiny as a male. His social and spiritual successes endow him with a virile prestige. He's not divided. Whereas it is required of women that in order to realize her femininity, she must make herself object and prey, which is to say that she must renounce her claims as a sovereign subject.
And submit to male authority. Unlike English and American polemicists, Beauvoir casts her arguments using the basic principles of the existentialist philosophy she and Sartre were building, that we each establish our own value through our actions, not through predetermined privilege. Unlike Sartre, however, Beauvoir made the philosophy human and touchable in daily life. Finally, though, it was Beauvoir's fearless gaze into the pains and exclusions of the marginalized that set her apart from almost everyone. In her seminal work on aging, like women in her youth, the old are cast aside. In this passage, she dwelt on her own face.
I love my appearance now. The eyebrows slipping down towards the eyes, the bags underneath, the excessive fullness of the cheeks, and that air of sadness around the mouth that wrinkles always bring. Yes, yes, the moment has come to say, never again. Never again shall I collapse, drunk with fatigue, into the smell of hay. Never again shall I slide down through the solitary morning snows. Never again a man.
Now, 2 decades after both Beauvoir and Sartre have died, it is she who is most remembered. And in the view of Sartre's biographer, Annie Cohen-Solal, Beauvoir, who has exercised the greatest influence.
Simone de Beauvoir, she really applied the tools of existentialism to everyday life. For example, the way they live their personal life, you know, this recomposed family. It's something that was absolutely unthinkable, you know, in the French provinces when they were young. She handled it both as a thinker and as a woman in a very, very open way.
Which is why this year has seen a half dozen new and reissued books praising and attacking, especially by men, her life and work. And why almost every week there's a seminar somewhere in the world about the work of Simone de Beauvoir. For NPR News, I'm Frank Browning in Paris.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.